I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Hollis Walker. She is author of the new book, The Booby Blog, A Cancer Chronicle. She will be speaking this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe, and then on Saturday at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 5 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Hollis, as many of our listeners know, has been on both sides of the table here at the baking company, is often a guest host on the show. Now, you were diagnosed with breast cancer nearly 2 years ago, and being a writer and an articulate person, one of your responses was both to write a blog for your friends and to write a journal for yourself. What did you do in each of these?
Well, the blog came about because I realized immediately I was going to have a way to keep everyone up to date with what was happening. And so it started out, I just had like 10 people, my closest friends and family, on the list, and then it just sort of grew like Topsy. People would find out I had breast cancer, they wanted to know what was going on, so I just started adding people to this email list until it grew to be pretty big. And the journal was, I'm a journaler as well as a journalist, and I mean, I've kept a diary since I was a kid, so it was really natural for me to do that. And I felt that having cancer was a really big deal, and I wanted to write about that separate and apart from my daily, you know, vomitus about whatever was bothering me that day.
Right, and I mean, it's also, you know, when you're writing to your friends, you're both sharing with them and you're protecting them.
Right, yeah, I did write a little bit more, I think a little bit more honestly or with more vulnerability in the journal because I didn't anticipate anyone would ever read that.
Right. Now, one of the many things I found interesting in your writing was that you decided early on not to use a battlefield metaphor for cancer.
Right.
What did you do instead?
I talked to my cancer, and especially in the part about undergoing radiation, I sort of prayed to my cancer. Because, you know, the battlefield metaphor for dealing with disease comes out of this very patriarchal place. And most women especially don't have that living experience of being a soldier and fighting something. So it's not natural to me to do that. Maybe it would be for someone, a woman who had been a soldier. But for me, I needed to embrace and accept what had happened in my body and that this was a part of me. It wasn't some evil within me. That felt kind of creepy, you know, like there was some, like the movie Alien when that thing comes out of her chest. It's like, no, I didn't feel like that. It was just some cells that went down the wrong road, you know. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it is interesting because it really has, I mean, the metaphors of healing are so interesting because one does wonder whether the battle with cancer, quote-unquote, whether that metaphor and the fighting and the cutting and the slashing, which really do have a kind of militaristic overtones in the way we address it, are really the most effective.
Right, and they may in fact be damaging. You know, there is so much violence in the treatment of cancer. You know, when people are cutting open your body, there's already a lot of built-in violence that's happening. You're radiating your body. So my thinking is anything that counters that.
Yeah.
And also the whole battlefield militaristic thing is resistance. And, you know, resistance is not a good thing for us for the most part. Much better to surrender and to accept what's going on and move through it. To me, at least.
Yeah, depending on the situation, of course.
Sure.
When burglars come into your house.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, and that's the thing. It's like, what is this thing? And there's a deep mystery around this illness, which in your case, luckily, was caught very early. And in an almost sort of semi-mystical way, you woke up one morning. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I woke up one morning and I heard this voice in my head that said, it was sort of like, you know, this disembodied, you have a lump in your left breast. And I realized I was sort of lying there with my hand on my left breast. And so I sort of felt around, and sure enough, there was this lump in it. And, you know, part of me was like, yeah. And, you know, I felt around some more, and it was like very clearly a very distinct lump in my breast. And I had this sense that it was cancer. Just, you know, sort of like I knew before I had any testing done.
Now, you became a chaplain, sort of late career. Do you feel like your intuition on things like this was developed by having gone into that line of work?
I'm not sure that my personal intuition was necessarily affected by that. It has been definitely affected by the spiritual path that I've been on for a long time. My intuition about other people has developed a great deal since becoming a chaplain.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and this is another part of it that I think is so interesting and important, is that you had really wonderfully supportive friends and family, people around you, people to go to appointments with you, people giving you beautiful things. And it turns out that people with really close relationships actually survive better and survive longer.
Yeah, right. And I had read this, that in, I think it was one of Lawrence LeShane's books, about that a woman who had 10 friends she could list had a huge percentage greater chance of surviving cancer than those who didn't. And one of the things I tell women with cancer, that I tell people with any illness, is that they should take advantage of their friends, that their friends and family want to help them. Often they don't know how, or they're afraid to talk about it. But you, the patient, can ask for and solicit the kind of help you need that will help you heal ultimately. But in doing so, you give a gift to the person who's helping you. You know, I mean, think about the last time you offered your own generous help to someone you care about, and you came away from it. It was nice that they enjoyed that casserole you took them, but it made you feel so good to give them that casserole. You know,
yeah.
And that's so it's a two-way street, you know.
Well, and a lot of people don't know how to help when somebody is sick,
right.
And a lot of people are frightened.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they're frightened. They don't know what to say. And, you know, my best advice about what to say to people is to avoid giving advice and to avoid telling stories. A lot of people think they need to tell the story of Aunt Jenny and her cancer and how she survived it or how she didn't, you know. And those stories sort of diminish the patient's feeling of agency about their own experience. So, you know, it's more like, I love you. I want to help you. What can I do? How about I bring you dinner? You tell me a day and I'll bring it.
Yeah.
You know, and also for the patient, when someone says, God, I really want to help and I don't know what to do, to give them specific instructions.
Yeah.
You know, to say, gosh, you know, if somebody came over and went to the grocery store for me, it would be such a relief, you know.
Yeah. And there is something about the bringing of food.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the most nurturing possible thing.
Mm-hmm. And even when you can't eat that food, I remember when a friend of mine was dying, Jackie Present, wonderful woman, everyone was bringing her food. There was just, and her house was filled with food. And, you know, she was eating less and less because she was dying. And that's okay. Everyone else who came to the house ate food. She was able to give away food.
Right.
And, you know, that whole thing for us culturally and just as human beings, food is nurture, you know.
Another part of the healing process was not only friendship, but also beauty.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And being out in nature. And that continues to be important for me in a way it never was before. I mean, and I was an art critic, you know, for a long time, so I spent a lot of time looking at beauty. But, yeah, finding beauty in my life and in the world around me.
So one thing that we have to talk about, because it's a really important part of this. I mean, here we are talking about relationships and friendships and nurturing, and then you go into the medical system.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many different ways in which it's broken, and one of them that you talk about is that people don't really connect with you.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and I have to say, I honestly think most people go into the medical world because they want to help other people. You know, there's the rare person who is only interested in the technology, and they usually hopefully end up in the lab, right? But most people want to help people. But our system isn't designed to allow for that. You know, a lot of doctors are on this schedule where they're supposed to see a patient every 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, the nurse has this giant form she has to fill out on the computer every time you go in. That's meaningless for the most part, but they're just, you know. So, yeah, there's this complete loss of attention to the psycho-spiritual needs of the patient. And, you know, this is why so many people turn to alternative medicine and to, you know, shamanistic healings and things like that. Here is someone who will look me in the eyes, talk to me, listen to me, and touch my body, you know. And there is something deeply healing in that you cannot get from this person in a white lab coat standing across the room typing on a computer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the thing that I hate the most is when you go in and they're on the computer taking notes and they're like, and what's your pain level today on a scale of 1 to 10? You know, and I'm sitting there, I could be sitting there crying and my face could be purple and they'd be typing on the computer instead of, you know, looking at me and going, wow, it looks like you're having a really hard day, Hollis. What's going on? That's all you want, right?
Right.
You know, we know that they can't fix it most of the time. But just to have someone express their real human caring for you is so important.
And as you put it in the book, to acknowledge your suffering,
yes,
to acknowledge your pain, to acknowledge your fear.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, there's one point in there that talks about the tattooing process when you get radiation.
Yeah, what is that? They actually tattoo you?
They tattoo you.
You still have a tattoo?
I've got, more than one tattoo. They're just little dots, but they're making these little dots like so they can line up the trajectory of the radiation machine, which is very precise to your body. But, you know, maybe for some people it doesn't hurt at all. Maybe I'm extra sensitive. But, you know, it's kind of like somebody shooting you with a nail gun in the breast. It was... And what they said to me, this might sting a little, you know, and it's really a good thing I didn't come off that table and, you know, knock the radiation tech to the ground. But, you know, what I say in the book is how come they don't take your hand and say, this might, it's okay to say this might hurt a little, right? This might hurt a little. Squeeze my hand really hard if you need to. Whatever. Human contact, right? It diminishes the suffering. And it also doesn't pretend it's not going to hurt, you know.
And it's funny because the way our society is lined up, the art of healing is really offloaded. I mean, it's sort of gone within the medical system. The science and technology of healing has been elevated. And I think a lot of people say, well, you know, the science and technology are great. You go find your nurturing somewhere else. But a lot of your time and the amount of time that you spend within the system is really huge.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the place where you're supposed to be healing. And if you're not getting it there, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you would do studies of this, but it seems like it would really be better for the patient if they had some nurturing from the inside of the system.
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to take that much time, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, it's really a shift in attitude more than it is spending hours and hours more time. I mean, and also I think medical systems such as hospitals and cancer centers need to take advantage of the people that they have on their staffs. You know, there are chaplains on most hospital staffs. And until a physician gets into their back against the wall and the chaplain comes and bails them out, they don't realize how important that nurturing, that listening, that witness of suffering is. So, you know, there are ways to do this, to help the patient already in place that just aren't being plumbed enough, in my opinion.
Now, are you teaching this?
No, but I want to. Really badly.
Yeah.
Even when I was going through this experience, I thought, you know, I want to do in-service for medical people and talk about these things. And I hope that I can find the opportunity to do that. I am working, as you know, I'm doing workshops for women with breast cancer and reproductive cancer. The Cancer Foundation for New Mexico, a wonderful organization that spends its money locally with people who have cancer, is hosting workshops every second Saturday of the month from 10 to 12:30 at the Cancer Foundation offices, which is over on Zia Road across from the Cancer Center. So I'm doing these workshops for women there, and they're basically sort of inspirational, nurturing workshops to help us, you know, have support as we go through these things. And they're free.
Also a very good part of it. We're talking to Hollis Walker about her new book, The Booby Blog, A Cancer Chronicle. And the money part of it is also another way in which the system is broken. I mean, this is so weird, but you had the good fortune to have had a bad year economically. If you'd made a few more dollars that year, that tax year before you got sick, you wouldn't have qualified for Medicaid, and you would have been in the hole hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right, of debt, exactly.
Debt.
And that was before Obamacare came into play as well.
Right.
So, and many of the people, the women I know with cancer, are in terrible debt because they are responsible for a lot of their own care, and they can't work, many of them, while they're sick. And sometimes for a long time after active treatment even. And, you know, they're broke. if they're lucky enough, they've got family or people who can help them out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's another thing is, and I've experienced this and you've really experienced it, you know, you say, oh, after surgery, how long a recovery time do I have? And they'll say, oh, 5 minutes or two days,
right.
Or, you know, some like ridiculously short amount of time.
Right.
And for most of us, it's way longer.
Right. You know, you have to remember that physicians have rarely had the surgeries that they are performing on you.
Right.
And I haven't talked to my surgeon since I met with her once after my surgery. How the heck would she know how long it takes her patients to really feel like themselves again? You know, and the other thing is they do dozens of them a day. So they're inured to the whole process. Even though they may be caring individuals, it's, you know, it's just another lumpectomy to them. So,
right, but still, I mean, there is so much scientific accurate information about all kinds of things, you'd think there would be accurate information about recovery time.
Right, and I also think one of the things that comes into play here is, and I don't know if they teach them this in medical school or what, that they think that they should be less than honest with us. Like if they say you're really going to hurt pretty bad for about 6 weeks, then there'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy in that, you know, and that they want to diminish how bad it's going to hurt so you're not fearful and so that you don't experience worse pain. But, you know, I'm a realist. I want to know the truth up front. And if you don't tell me, I'm not very happy with you. I don't respect you either.
Right.
You know, yeah, because you're not respecting me if you don't tell me the truth, the medical caregiver, you know.
So basically, you go through a surgery where they take out the lump and they take out some lymph nodes. And then you go through a period of recovery that is seriously longer than you'd ever thought. Then you start radiation, and it turns out that radiation is cumulative. Like, each treatment, you get a little more tired and need a few more naps.
Mm-hmm. And you get sunburned. And, I mean, it's literally, it's the same as a sunburn, right? Because you're being radiated. So your skin, where you're being radiated, and this is true for anyone that receives radiation, becomes burned. And it's very individual how that affects you. It doesn't have to do with skin color. It doesn't have to do with ethnicity or any age, any of those things. Some people burn really badly. Some don't, you know. So you can't really predict that. But, yeah, the fatigue thing, I call it non-negotiable fatigue. You know, and in the beginning you're fine, and then the more radiation your body takes in toward the end, you know, of my 36 treatments or whatever, I was taking not one but two naps a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to lie down right now.
Right.
Yeah.
And for the people who can only survive by going back to work, not only is it extremely difficult for them, but it's utterly antithetical to the healing process.
Exactly. And, you know, and the other thing is I have to say, you know, my cancer was caught very early. My experience and the treatment that I had to undergo, I call it cancer light. I know so many women and so many people who have been through incredible numbers of surgeries, multiple surgeries, chemotherapy over and over and over again. So, you know, if my experience was unpleasant, imagine what it's like for those people.
Cancer light, L-I-T-E.
Yeah, that's how I spell it.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet what you go through, you have in common with people
right.
who've been through far worse. You're sort of in some kind of little club together almost.
It's a weird sisterhood, I'll tell you, and brotherhood. I do have a good friend who had, a male friend who had breast cancer.
Yeah.
And went through everything, just like a woman did. He had to have a mastectomy, he had to have radiation, he had to have chemotherapy. You know, it was very difficult.
Yet another problem, sorry medical profession, but, you know, it's another problem with the medical profession is that very few doctors have training or are able to give any advice on healthy nutrition and lifestyle.
Oh my gosh, is that amazing? I asked people and they're sort of like, yeah, well, you know, nah. You know, there was no real advice in that direction until I went to see an MD here who practices complementary or integrative medicine. So she has a big focus on nutrition and using supplements and vitamins and things like that. So I was lucky because I could afford to pay her out of pocket. People gave me enough money that I could afford to pay her and get some good advice along those lines.
And that's tricky too, because then you have this kitchen covered with bottles and you don't know how much of that stuff really works and what you're just putting back into the, you know, the waste treatment plant.
Right. You know, in Santa Fe, if you think about it, our wastewater treatment transplant is like really healthy.
Yeah, and full of who knows what.
Right.
How did you negotiate that? You just said, let's take it all and hope it works and I'll never know what it was?
I did see a nutritionist at first and tried a few things. And I also was seeing an acupuncturist who had me taking a few things. And then I saw, as I mentioned, this fabulous doctor who practices complementary medicine. And I pretty much stuck with her recommendations. However, I have really bad gut problems, and after a while, taking 25 different things a day seemed to be part of, you know, my trouble with my gut at the time, taking a big toll. And so at some point, I quit taking everything except prescription medications.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't tell what it was that was killing my gut, you know. And ultimately, I decided I felt that it was the radiation, because it was that cumulative effect. By the end of the radiation, I started to have really serious gut problems. Now, if you asked a medical doctor, they would say, well, no, the radiation only affects your breast. It couldn't affect your stomach. Now, if you had radiation on your gut, for example, for colon cancer or something, yes, you might have those side effects. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're radiating me and you're telling me it's only affecting my breast?
Right.
I just don't buy it. You know, I'm not a scientist. I can't refute that, but I just don't buy it. I think it affects your whole body. So.
Well, and for example, you had this experience where your hair started falling out.
Oh, right.
You hadn't had chemotherapy. You said to the doctor, I think it was a general anesthesia. The doctor said, no, it wasn't. You Googled it, and it turned out that is, in fact, a potential side effect.
It is, and I don't know if that was truly what caused it for me, but, you know, and I do feel sorry for medical people because, you know, most patients do go home and read everything on the internet, and they come back armed with their stuff, and they're sure they're experts. And, you know, I'm sure that's a very difficult ground for your doctor to navigate. How to treat you with respect. You've done this research. Certainly some of it's accurate. But maybe you're also reading, you know, sites that are not exactly scientific. So, you know.
Yeah, it's very tricky business. And, of course, we don't have access to the real medical sites. You know, we don't have access to the scientific papers,
right,
if we could even read them anyway.
Right. Yeah. And I did read some, and they are difficult, but I have a background, some background in medicine, so I can read more than most people, but still it is really hard to, you know, make sense of those things.
We're talking to Hollis Walker. Now, there's another dimension to this, which I think is very important, which is that for you and for many people, going through a serious, potentially life-threatening disease brings up feelings of disempowerment that are left over from perhaps medical experiences that people had when they were children.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a chronic illness as a child, and I spent a lot of time going back and forth to the hospital and having lots of nasty studies and treatments done and things like that. And so I was quite consciously aware that being in medical world again was triggering me and bringing up some of that stuff. Hopefully, because I was aware of it, I wasn't quite as triggered as I might have been. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of haunted by something that you described, which was that when you were 10 years old, you were naked, lying butt up on a table, and the doctor invited a bunch of other young physicians to come in and observe you.
Right.
I want to punch him.
Yeah, and you know, I would too. And that was reflected, and my own response was heightened when I was in radiation for cancer, and they were bringing students into the room and not asking my permission in advance, not introducing the student. I would just show up. There would be the regular four techs, and there would be some other person, you know. And perhaps some people wouldn't even notice. Maybe some people wouldn't care. But you're naked, you know. You're very vulnerable. You're already in this state of anxiety because you have cancer. And here's this guy. You know, it's like, who are you? Why are you here? How come you guys haven't told me this? And so I got to be very assertive about that. And I ultimately said I didn't want any students in the room, you know, because it was uncomfortable for me. And, you know, I think everybody should know that. You don't have to let other people in the room with you, you know.
And that was then respected.
Absolutely, it was, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it does, I mean, this is the thing. It's like there's so much good that's come from medicine, you know, from the science of medicine, which treats cells as mechanisms, and we try to understand these mechanisms, and, you know, here you are. You're alive today.
I'm alive, absolutely.
We're on the radio because of that attitude, and yet the downside of it is not acknowledging the human relationship. And as you said before, people with strong relationships survive better.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so why isn't that in the medical mm-hmm. system?
Well, and there's something in the field between you and any healer that it is that energy exchange, that deep yeah. connection that can occur, and it can occur very quickly in very few moments and on a very deep level, and it's absolutely essential to healing, I think.
And it's funny because you don't have that, even with very kind practitioners, you don't always have that with somebody whom you meet.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you do. I remember once one of my uncles came to Santa Fe, and he had an illness, and he, for some reason, he wanted to go to a homeopath. And mm-hmm. I took him to a homeopath whom I'd heard of. And they just, like, you could see them falling in love with each
mm-hmm.
other.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to her, and there was nothing.
Interesting, yeah. Uh-huh. It's a very personal thing. You know, I have that kind of interaction with my patients when I'm working as a chaplain on this very deep level, and you're just connected.
Yeah.
And you know that whatever it is you're giving each other is good energy, and it's good for both of you. And, you know, go ahead.
I suppose the training of the chaplain is you learn to do that with more and more people, even people who you wouldn't have maybe
right.
a natural sort of friendship or love connection with.
Exactly. Yeah, and to listen on a really deep level to what people are saying, to be the witness and not to bring your own baggage into the conversation. So, yeah.
Very interesting. So what happens when the treatment is finished? I mean, there's this question of when's it over? Are you
right.
cured?
Oh,
how
right.
do you think about it?
Mm. I think about it every single day. There is some point every single day when I think to myself, wow, do I have cancer again and I don't know it? You know, you can't help it. And one of the questions that women ask in these workshops I give is, am I cured? Is it over? How do I know? And the answer is you don't. You will never know. We can't ever know. And the truth is that everyone in this cafe with us today is in the same situation. They just don't know it, right? Because we all have mutating cells in our bodies all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, is your body okay enough right now to dispel them, to recognize, oop, that's a mutated cell, I'm going to send it out. Or is it busily creating more of them,
yeah.
you know, that's going to create a cancer or some other form of disease? And so we, in other words, it's a very deep spiritual but we're all, it's about impermanence. We're here for this second, and we don't know how much longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I try not to dwell on it or let it make me depressed or whatever. You have to live your life. You know, and a friend and I call this a cancer vacation. Take a cancer vacation. Don't think about it for a while. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like you can, on some level, I mean, there are people whose heart's desire is to go back to the way things were
yes.
before. And then other people, and I think you're one of them, who find that their lives have changed really for the better in some ways.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, I believe that within disease, we can find meaning. I don't mean that disease has inherent meaning. I don't think God made me have this or anything like that. But I can look at this experience and say, okay, how am I going to make meaning out of it? How can it change my life? And that's what I've tried to do. And that seemed like a very natural process to me.
So how has your life changed? How have your habits changed? How has your diet changed?
Oh, how's my diet changed? Well, I had estrogen receptor positive cancer, which means that estrogen fed my cancer. So the theory is, well, we should keep your estrogen levels low as possible, right? I decided for myself not to take estrogen suppressant drugs for a variety of reasons. But the other things I do is I don't eat dairy because if you think about it, if you're eating dairy, dairy is made from milk. Milk comes from what? Lactating animals. Lactating animals are full of estrogen. So, you know, if you eat dairy, you are in some way ingesting estrogen. So no dairy. I don't do soy. Soy has estrogen. It's phytoestrogen. This is the way it's been explained to me. It's different than mammalian estrogen, but we don't know yet whether, you know, phytoestrogens might have that same effect. So I don't do soy either. I have a pretty good diet. You know, I mainly eat like grass-fed beef and organic chicken and brown rice and lots of vegetables. And
I love how you craved meat.
I did.
After your surgery.
I'm telling you, it was my body, because I had not ever been a big red meat eater, but I really, really ate a lot of red meat for a while there. And I just try to eat high quality food, because I think all that, you know, we're never going to know exactly what's good and bad for us. You know, what's good today is bad tomorrow. So, you know, all things in moderation, as Benjamin Franklin said. And I do eat sugar. I am not sugar free. You know, it's who I am. I love my cookies. I'm sorry. You know? And I do, you know, I exercise a lot. I run walk, and I run walk almost every day. So I try to keep myself in good shape.
What about other things? I mean, the way you approach, for example, your work or your mm-hmm. friendships, have those things shifted also?
I think they have. I'm a lot more relaxed, and I'm certainly not making a lot of money, but I have gained this level of trust that things are going to unfold. And that if I feel that I'm doing the work I need to do, what's in front of me, that it will work out. And so far, that's been the case. So I'm less anxious in that way. And I am much more interested in the people in my life. And, you know, if a dirty house is calling, it's just going to have to stay dirty if I'm with a human being that I'm connected with. You know, I'd much rather do that. So
there are many of us who live stressful lives, and there are many of us who aren't eating as well as we could, and who aren't getting as much exercise as we need, and who, you know, you get out of touch with yourself mm-hmm. if you kind of choose this, or you choose this sort of high-powered career kind of thing, or mm-hmm. if it chooses you. And then you know, some people will then have a health crisis, and then they'll look back and say, gosh, I could have done something differently had I thought about things differently. So if you could speak to people who are like that, or if you could speak to your younger self, yourself from 10, 15, 20 years ago, what would you say?
Huh. Well, I think that, you know, the thing about cancer or having some huge event like that happen is that it suddenly gives you permission to put the focus on yourself and act in your own best interests. And I think most of the time we're acting based on some idealized movie we've got in our head of what our career or our life or whatever should look like. And most of us, I think, suffer in some regard from low self-esteem and the idea that we don't deserve to take care of ourselves. And I think, so when I got cancer, it was like, oh, I really have to take care of myself.
Right.
And I had a reason that I could say no to anything I wanted to say no to, you know, and I could make the most important thing I did to be to take a walk every morning or whatever. And so I think that the trick is finding a way to value your own life enough to say, you know, I deserve this. And also, I mean, I tell people this all the time, if you don't take a break and treat yourself well, your work is not going to be as good as it would be otherwise. If you are well, if you're happy, if you're rested, if you've had your spiritual practice and your exercise and your yummy, healthy food, then when you do your work, it's going to be better anyway. So,
yeah. And, you know, we're living in this kind of crazy time where many people are expected to be more and more productive.
Right.
For less and less money, and mm-hmm. you know, the job of what used to be three people is done by two, or the job of five people is done by one, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to place that onus on the individual and the individual's choices. It's like, you know, yes, there is. I mean, I asked you the question about what would help can people do differently, but there's also this sort of society-wide question of how can we treat our peers, our employees, our companies mm-hmm. in a way that's really healthy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm reminded of a guy that was one of my first bosses, Dion Holt. He was the president of a community college I worked for, and his door was always open, and we had a little group lunch every Friday, and Dion, the president of this college, made food and brought it every time.
Yeah.
You know, and it is up to the bosses, I think, a lot of the time, to set be the role models for the rest of us. You know, so, you know, a boss who goes home at 5 o'clock or whenever the workday is done is a good role model for other people. But I do think sometimes people have to make really hard choices about their careers and what they, you know, what are they willing to give up. And, you know, I used to fantasize about being working in a coffee shop, you know, or I used to joke with my old boss, Rob Dean, the former managing editor at the New Mexican, about being a greeter at Walmart. Doesn't that sound like fun? You just stand there and say, hi. Well, but you know what I'm saying? It's a job that one imagines is fairly low stress, that, you know, you show up on time for your shift, you do it, and you go home.
Yeah.
And you smile at people all day. So,
Hollis Walker is a journalist. She's author of the new book, The Booby Blog, A Cancer Chronicle. And she will be speaking on Saturday at Bookworks in Albuquerque at 5 o'clock and this Thursday at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And starting in December, she will also be giving a workshop at the Cancer Foundation the second Saturday of each month. And so to find out more about that, what can people do?
You know, people can call me on the phone, 577-6763. It's area code 505, especially about the workshops. I'll tell you all about them.
Give the number one more time.
577-6763.
And if you missed that, you can write to me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. And we want to also give a shout out to Alexandra Eldridge for the beautiful cover art on this book, which was controversial because there's little sweet angelic breasts on it. But that's a story for another time.
That's another story, yeah.
Hollis, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, MC.